I would like to welcome everyone for this important discussion on the role and the policies of Russia in the Middle East. We are very fortunate to have today two experts on Russian affairs and Russia's policies in the Middle East. I would like to thank everyone for your time and for your interest for coming to this important event. I am sure you will find the discussion very interesting. It will be very challenging, thought-provoking for all of us. We look forward to this very interesting discussion on a question that has been at the core of interest of the Middle East audience on the development of the Russian policies in the region. Russia's policies are not new in the region. The relations are not new with the region. We all remember the Russia relations with Egypt back in the 50s and the 60s. And how it developed over the 70s and through the Soviet Union, of course, and then later with Iraq and with Syria, where Syria became the major Arab country in alliance with Russia, with strong relations with Russia. So over the past 50 years, the role of Russia has evolved it has always been important. Today, probably is one of those very important steps and those very important positions of how the Russian position has developed and affected the political, social, economic developments in the region. And that's why we have many that have been trying to understand this role and how it is going to develop and to evolve, whether it's about Syria or Egypt recently with the movements and the changes in Egypt or in the rest of the region. For all these questions and for others, I'm sure you have many questions. Again, please join me in welcoming Professor Vitaly Nomkin and Professor Adnan Hayajni to discuss this important question. I would like to begin first with Professor Nomkin. He is the president of the International Center for Strategic and Political Studies in Moscow. He is a renowned scholar on the Arab and Muslim world.
But my main hat is director of the Institute of Oriental Studies.
Yes.
My first hat. This was the second.
Okay. Professor Nomkin is also the director of the Center for Arab Studies.
I am director of this institute. It's very old information. Sorry to say that.
Okay, of Oriental Studies, Russian Academy of Science, and chair of the Faculty of World Politics at Moscow University, Moscow State University. He is fluent in Russian, Arabic, English, French, German, and other languages, and has published over 400 publications. We'd like to welcome you again, and the floor is yours. You have 15 to 20 minutes, Professor Brown.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here and to speak to this distinguished audience. Thank you for inviting me. And the question is really now fashionable because so on many occasions I was able to discuss it with many people in different parts of the world, especially in the Middle East, where this policy is part of political environment. We can start with the fact that, in my view, in the last months and probably a couple of years, so Middle East became more important for Russia in its, system of foreign policy priorities. Several years ago, I would say that I was able to say that probably Middle East was not a priority because we were more concerned with our relationship with the countries bordering the Commonwealth states, especially Turkey and Iran. And Turkey, by the way, is one of the main partners of Russia in the field of economics, also an important political and strategic partner, despite the fact that Turkey is a NATO country. Iran is also very important, and so you know about the relationship between Russia and Iran, probably. But after the Arab Spring, the Middle East was prioritized in the Russian foreign policy activities, if we judge on the, you know, trips the Russian diplomats are making and the number of negotiations and contacts and number of delegations coming to Moscow. We can say that probably the Middle East, as everywhere, is now a very important part of the world and very important for Russia's interests. Though I can acknowledge that still this region as a whole is not a region of major Russian national interests. We don't have significant presence in the Arab world. Our trade and economic ties are not as, you know, important for Russia in comparison with other states, as I said, like Turkey or China or India or Germany or some other states as well. So I think, but still, given the strategic importance of this region and the turbulence that was brought by the Arab Spring, so this region is a part of very intensive Russian diplomatic activities. So there are a lot of misperceptions about Russia's stance, Russia's view on the Arab Spring, as if Russia was against it, or its interest was against these changes, or there is also a misperception that Russia is a status quo state, whereas, for instance, the United States is now more like a revisionist power. It's not quite true. Russia is not a status quo power. Russia welcomed the Arab Spring, but was cautious about expressing its attitude, because in general, Russia is more conservative, and not as, I would say, emotional in expressing, and quick in expressing its position on many developments in the world. So that's why during the first revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, everything was more or less clear. So Russia, after some pause, supported these movements as genuine expression of people's dream about freedoms and equal opportunities for everyone, against corruption, against authoritarian rule and whatever. But during Libya it was a different story.
Yes.
Quite a different story. And I can say that the Libyan syndrome is available in Russia. I can tell you that when Russia abstained from voting on resolution 1973, this decision and let the no-fly zone pass through Security Council. Later, this decision was broadly criticized in the Russian public opinion. Don't have another misperception. We have public opinion. We have a lot of debates about our foreign policy as well. Even President Medvedev was criticized open for this decision. And the overwhelming view was that Russia was cheated by our partners, and no-fly zone turned into direct military intervention. But the Russian view about the world order is based on very negative attitude towards any sort of intervention without mandate, direct, clear mandate from Security Council of the United Nations, and respect to national sovereignty, non-use of force unless it's sanctioned by Security Council, and of course the role of international law, and so it's well known. So it's a matter of philosophy than the matter of pragmatic interests. So jumping to the Syrian issue, I can say that we didn't have any substantial pragmatic interests in Syria. Like, another misperception is about the importance of the so-called base in Tartus. It's a technical facility which can be easily replaced by any other place. Not important. Trade is not significant to Syria. I said that, for instance, with Turkey we have much more interests than with Syria, or with Algeria, for instance, where we have very substantial trade relationship, and with some other states as well. So, going back to that, so the lessons of Libya have been learned, as one of the Russian top officials said. We have learned lessons from Libya well. And that was one of the drivers for the Russian stance on Syria and on the Russian voting in Security Council. Not because from the very beginning Russia supported Assad personally or the government as a whole, or was blind towards violations of human rights, but also jumping to Syria, I can say, as one of my American colleagues, an American general, is saying, he said that in civil wars there are no bad guys and good guys. There are only winners and losers. So, but we'll come to that. I can turn now to Egypt and to the problem of the winners in the first wave of the Arab Spring, which ended with the government of victory of Muslim Brothers. And that created a problem for Russia, because the Muslim Brotherhood was on the blacklist in Russia as a whole, as a movement. So Moscow understood that there were, you know, moderate factions within that, less moderate factions. Some of them, the reason was the involvement of certain factions of the Muslim Brothers or related to Muslim Brothers in the conflict in Chechnya and the support towards the separatist movement. And of course Russia was sensitive about it. The second reason was that there is an ongoing interconfessional conflict within the Russian Ummah, Russian Muslim population, which is more than 20 million people, between the traditional Hanafi school of thought and those who came from the Arab world and some missionaries who are trying to profess a different view on the statehood in Russia and relationship between the Muslims and Christians, the Christian majority, and so on and so forth. So there is big sensitivity on this issue. So that's why probably Russia hesitated. On the one hand, understood that it is necessary to establish relations with the Muslim Brothers, and on the other hand, there was some special thing that I mentioned. Then President Putin decided to invite Morsi to Moscow. And it happened on the 19th of April this year. It was a significant shift in the Russia's policy towards the Islamic movements in general and the Muslim Brotherhood also. And President Morsi came. He asked for financial aid, for credit of $2 billion, a lot of economic projects like building, constructing nuclear power plants and gas pipelines and a lot of other things. So he was welcomed in general. So a lot of other, you know, projects were discussed during meeting between Putin and Morsi in Sochi. So then the problems for Morsi started, as you know. And then a different situation was created. We can say that if the Russia's position, I think, before the third revolution in Egypt had been weakened by the Syrian crisis and Russia's position on Syria, it's clear that we have some problems with the reputation of Russia and our relationship with a lot of groups here in this part of the world. But with the third revolution, the Egyptians turned to Russia. Russia was invited to Egypt, given the difficult relationship between new government in Egypt and some certain deterioration of relationship between Egypt and the United States and some other states in this part of the world, probably including this country, Turkey, and some other countries supportive towards President Morsi. But now it has been repaired. And I think it will go on because everybody is interested in stability in this region and everybody hopes that it will come to a natural course of, you know, democratic elections and constitution and so on and so forth. But still, a new possibility was opened for Russia. A new format was opened, meetings between 2+2, Russia's, Russia's relationship with Egypt is witnessing very good transformation, positive transformation. It's very active. It will be continued. And so we'll come now, because the time is going, you know, what will come to the next important events in given the situation in Syria, towards Syrian crisis. Russia is still sticking to the to its principle that the solution of the crisis should be done by Syrians themselves without any intervention. And Russia is very, very, very much alarmed by the growing role of the jihadists in Syria. And so for all this time, Russia is calling for reconciliation, for negotiations in Syria, for national dialogue. So Geneva II came as a fact of agreement, final agreement between Russia and the United States, which is very important. It was based on the previous agreement on the liquidation of chemical weapons, where Russia played a very positive role. It was Russia's initiative. And the fact that this region hopefully will be deprived of the chemical weapons, I think it's a big achievement. Done by many countries, mainly United States and Russia. And it was very, very important step, as well as the step towards the Iran's nuclear program. It's another, I think, very important point in the Russia's policy in the region, where also Russia has been very active in contacts with the Iranians. And it was also a matter of understanding between Russia and its Western partners. And as you know, it's only the first step. I hope that it will be continued. My view is that this interim agreement will be followed by another interim agreement. Probably it can last long. I cannot envisage some magic solution for that, very quick solution, final solution for the Iranian nuclear program, but still, I believe that these two occasions can also contribute to the improvement of the situation around prospects of Geneva II. That are extremely difficult, given that the Syrian army and security forces are demonstrating striking cohesion. And of course, there are divisions, I believe, as everywhere in these forces, but still there is an illusion on both sides of the civil war that every party believes that it can win. The same about the opposite side, about their position. Russia has been contacting different opposition groups. It's very active in building relationship with the opposition groups, trying to convince both sides. Especially Russia contributed in convincing Assad's government in coming to Geneva II. But the divisions within the opposition, and especially the growing role, as I said, of the jihadist groups like Nusra or ICIL, Dawla Islamiya or Iraq al-Sham, of course, that are not eager to participate in any negotiations. And you know about the obstacles of participation, obstacles of who has to be invited, whether it's because we insist on inviting Iran, and some partners are against this. Some parties are against inviting Saudi Arabia, which is also needed, and Russia has very constructive contacts with the Saudis, despite the very big differences in views on Syria. Amir Bandar is a frequent visitor conducting dialogue in Moscow. And in general, I believe that coming to the final portion of my preliminary remarks, because I believe that it's better than we come to a dialogue among ourselves, I can conclude that I can see changes to the best, with the one reservation about acute humanitarian crisis in Egypt, in Syria, acute humanitarian catastrophe, which Russia recognizes. Russia is providing some assistance to certain groups of population in Syria. But to be very frank, I can see that this idea of humanitarian corridors, which is welcomed by certain states, not welcomed by other states, is an idea that is not shared by all, and we understand this very well. And the second thing is about the foreign fighters. We know that the people from the opposition, they believe that it should be a condition for a dialogue that Hezbollah and Iran withdraw their forces from Syria. But as they say, and it is right, that there are a lot of jihadist fighters on the other side from many countries. We have about more than 500 jihadists from Russia fighting in Syria, and it's dangerous because they will come back. And I know from my British colleagues that about 1,200 fighters with British passports are there. And so when I was speaking to some of the leaders from Hezbollah, they were saying that it's a preventive action, what they're doing in Lebanon, to prevent them from jihadists coming to Lebanon, which is already on the brink of explosion. So the sectarian dimension of all these conflicts, and especially the Syrian conflict and what's going on in the split over, and the threat of Somalization is of the threats that we're afraid of. So thank you for your attention. I'm ready to answer questions or to participate in discussion.
Thank you very much, Professor Namkin, for this great insights to the Russian policy in the region. Would like to hear now from Professor Adnan Hayajni. He is a visiting professor at Qatar University. He is also a political science professor at Hashemite University. Before that, he was a professor at Jordan, University of Jordan and the Jordan Institute of Diplomacy, University of Arizona as well. His research interest is in international relations, political and economic development, strategic and security studies, conflict resolution, and of course he has published over 40 publications. We're delighted to have Professor Adnan with us, and the floor is yours.
Shukran jazilan. Sa'atakallam bil lughat al arabiya.
In Arabic. First of all, I'm very grateful for the kind invitation from Brookings and Dr. Ibrahim Sharqiya to take part in this dialogue on the role of Russia in the region. I've written down some notes when I received the invitation about a week ago. I think from my academic point of view, I have been introduced as a professor here and a professor there. So professors speak in an academic language, and we try to focus on scientific facts rather than emotions or others. Without the Russian veto, we wouldn't be speaking this evening about a Russian role in the Middle East. I'll be alluding to different points. This will be a long evening. In case I get carried away, please, Ibrahim, remind me and stop me. I would like to be objective and scientific and emotionless. I'll be mentioning nothing about any political agendas. I'll try to be purely academic. The Arab Spring is not a Western conspiracy, as what Russia seems to think, and it wasn't an American conspiracy either. It was the result of Arab sacrifices for generations. It culminated in the Tunisian Revolution. In Libya, it was supported by outside forces. In Egypt, it was conspired against by many quarters. In Syria, there was a lot of outside intervention against it. So we must set aside right from now the question of conspiracy theories. The final word in the Arab Spring will not come in the next decade, maybe, which may be even longer, a very long time. The Arab world and the Arab homeland and the Arab countries cannot stay forever just playing pawns in a chess game run by the Russians and the Americans and others. They will have to have their own role. And as I will try to explain in my intervention, the Arab peoples are beginning to realize the basic principle in international relations, and that is to rely on their own points of strength. We relied on the Americans when the whole arena was theirs. They were the sole players since the end of the Cold War. They did nothing for us. Some questions which may arise here allude to the role of the Russians and how we can assess any Russian role. And when Ibrahim talked about that from a point of view of the people, not necessarily the regimes, especially when it pertains to the Arab Spring, how could Russia play an important role in the past? And I tried to look for justifications for the Russians from regional, national, local points of view, from internal Russian factors and factors relating to the Arab situation in general. Russia inherited the Soviet Union and with all its capabilities and the capability of playing an active role in international politics after the Cold War. This can be analyzed and enough evidence can be presented in support of this analysis. America had set down the rules of international cooperation and crisis management, and larger powers, including Russia, could only play a regional role and could never make it to the higher degree of international politics like the Americans were doing. For example, until, of course, when Putin came to power in 2000, when the situation has slightly changed, I will mention some indicators at the demographic, economic, and political levels which helps Russia play a role in this region. Russia and the Arab Spring. I think Russia has contributed to a great deal to contain the Arab Spring through coups and counter-revolutions, and the other powers, Russia included, bear responsibility for the failure of the Arab Spring so far and not materializing in a way which fulfills the aspirations of the people, and research centers should pay more attention to that. According to Freedom House indicators, the Arab world represents 50% of the remaining dictatorial regimes in the world at a time when the rest of the world is moving towards democratization. And also the policies adopted by Russia and others seem to be not to be based on any ethics, including the Syrian case, Iraq's case, Palestinian case, and they only commit themselves when they want to provide some humanitarian aid, when they send some blankets, medicine, etc. Our causes in the Arab world, in Syria, Palestine, Egypt, Iraq, they are not humanitarian cases or causes. They are not questions of floods and natural disasters. They are a lot more than that. They really are the causes of people who want to have their own say in their future and democratic aspirations. The Russian stance vis-à-vis Syria is a stigma. And I do not want to go through the figures. The entire Syrian question has been turned into a question of figures. How many refugees, how many victims of violence, how many children dead, how many this and how many that. I think the Arab viewer and the Arab citizens know only too well that Russia played a major role, not only in and stopping any possibility of the Americans delivering a military blow to the Assad regime, but even the establishment of a no-fly zone, even the establishment of some safe corridors, humanitarian corridors. Also, Russia found itself in a position of antagonism towards most Arab countries, even some Arab countries who may be wanting or thinking of having some strategic relations with Russia, like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Lebanon, etc. Russia, like what our colleague has said, that Russia learned from the Libyan situation, and I remember comments on Al Jazeera television that Russia will not repeat the same mistake, but they have, in fact, the first time they abstained from voting in on Libya before any possible solution, and in fact there were prospects looming in the horizon of political solution at that time, whereas in Syria they did that without any prospects of any solution. So I asked myself, can Russia play a role in the Middle East? I tried to find justifications for Russia, just to be objective nonetheless. I found Russian history in the Arab world is very negative. They could not withstand American pressure, except for the two or three occasions when they've used the veto. And since the end of the Cold War until now, I could not find one Russian stance in support of an Arab cause. Maybe there has been some support for some regimes in the Arab world, but not with the Arab people. Russia did not side with Iraq. They did not stand up against America in Iraq. Russia did not stand with Libya against military intervention. Russia did not play a conducive role in solving the Arab-Israeli conflict. Russia did not provide any military systems, any weapon systems which are really of any consequence and effect. And the Arab memory cannot forget what the Russians did against the Chechen Muslims and Bosnia-Herzegovina when they stopped against the intervention of NATO to save the Muslims from massacres and genocide. So therefore, from an Arab perspective, we cannot expect Russia to play any positive role, because the Americans always paid the Russians off. They rewarded them with things here and there to play a supporting or complementary role. Even the regional system, which was formed after the Arab Revolution, especially when we talk about the Turkey, Iran, Saudi, and Russia's role in the 5+1 agreement did not really serve the Russian interest, and the only thing the Russian foreign minister said was there was a need for them, apart, there's no justification apart from getting rid of the ballistic missiles in Europe, and the only reason for establishing this missile shield is to stop the threat of Iranian missiles hitting European targets. And also any talk of that Russia supports the Iranian intervention in order to continue the status quo in Syria and to stop any gas pipelines which can benefit Qatar or Iran. This is another justification which shows that Russia is not thinking as a superpower. As the role of Turkey, Russia stood against Turkey despite the strong economic relations between Turkey and Russia, which can reach some $30 billion a year. As for Saudi Arabia, which is a strong actor in the region and also can effect change vis-a-vis the Americans, there are no really any relations of any consequence apart from the visits paid by Prince Bandar, which is only to play the Russians against the Americans every now and then to avoid any agreement over the Iranian nuclear issue. But at the strategic level, Saudis did not really develop any strategic agreements, and the Saudis did not end up buying any weapons at any large scale. As for the Arab countries, most and by and large, these relations between Arab countries and Russia are just diplomatic niceties, nothing more. As for the Islamic perspective, this Islamic perspective and the fact that 15% of Russia's population are Muslim, this could have been a good entry point for Russia, and especially in the view of the fact that the largest increase in the population comes from Muslims, and some studies indicate that half of the conscripts for the Russian armed forces are Muslim. And many researchers think that the future in the Arab world is one of an Islamic identity after the collapse of pan-Arabism, communism, etc., and other ideologies. As for the, I think, how much time do I have? 5 minutes. Even if we take it for granted that the world system will turn into a bipolar system, I don't think this is possible if we compare Russian military expenditure with that of the American, or the size of the Russian economy with the size of the American economy. America on its own spends more than 20 countries, top spending countries put together. The number of the population in Russia is on the regression and decrease with the other ethnic conflicts and problems. I don't think, and on top of that, I don't think the Americans will allow the Russians to create such strategic changes in the area. It's true that the Arab countries do not have much say when it comes to strategic matters, and especially at the political and economic levels, but Russia doesn't have that ability either to impact change. So therefore, they should find other entry points to make some breakthroughs in the area. Finally, and in conclusion, I will mention them, and then we will leave it up to the audience to discuss. I think the Russian position vis-a-vis the Syrian revolution has weakened the Russian role in the area. And if we link that with the historic role and the Cold War and Russia's dealing with the Arab and Muslim causes after the Cold War, may have lost the Russians any possible role they may have been thinking of. And maybe the Russians are trying to just make some progress and edgeways into the area, but these roles are not given, they are taken. And as for Russia's internal situation, do not help the Russian position, and the regional environment does not help Russia either, even from a popular point of view. For example, any agreement between Russia and Egypt to provide Egypt with some weapon system, from the point of view of the general population, the vast majority of these weapons will be aimed at combating riots and stuff like that, tear gas and this kind of weapons. So how can this be possibly thought of as anything positive? The Russian role relied by and large on the American failures in the region, and from a strategic point of view, and when the region is seen as was handed over to some proxy powers, And this is not only when it comes to rid Iran of its nuclear powers, but to turn the clock backwards to the pre-Islamic revolution in Iran and reinsert American hegemony on the area. In fact, the Americans never left the area, and they will never allow anyone else to come in, whether the Russians or any other power. And if the financial situation in America continued, we're not talking about other costs in Iraq or Syria, and when Russia contributed in this from Afghanistan to Palestine, Iraq, Syria, and all these Arab countries, if we look pragmatically at this and other questions, the American-Israeli organic relationship and will not allow the Russians to play a major role after the Arab Spring, especially when the Palestinian cause is no longer occupying the main concern, and we do not have a resistance cap anymore. All these concepts have changed. I'll leave it here, and I hope I have not been too frank and didn't annoy anybody. But thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Adnan, for this great insights to the Russian role in the region. And let me thank you also in addition to our great speakers, Al Jazeera Mubasher, who is covering this discussion. I'm sure there is great interest in the Arab audience in the, this discussion and in the Russian policy. And for this reason, let me begin with a question to Dr. Nokin on the Russian position on Syria, which is, I think that's what most of the Arab audience would like to understand today, or this is what has been as like the major question within the Arab audience about what does Russia really want to achieve. I completely understand the reservations that Russia has over this relationship with the international community and how it worked with on the issue of Libya in particular, and the development of the Security Council Resolution 1973, and how the 1973 was stretched to the extent to the largest level possible to justify and explain different kinds of operations. So this is totally understandable, you know, of the Russian reservation over this and the way it's dealing with the Security Council. But the Russian position so far for many in the Arab region is not really clear. And most of the issues that mentioned in the Russian position, they're mostly to deal with the approach and the methods rather than the objectives and the goals. Meaning, when we talk about like the Russian role, is would like to see a national reconciliation, a dialogue, a Geneva II, the Syrian people solving the problem themselves. These are all national dialogue and national reconciliation, Geneva II, their methods, their approaches to achieving certain outcomes. What are the certain outcomes, my question is, that Russia would like to see, like in points really, you know, for the Arab audience, trying to understand what is Russia want to achieve in Syria in particular. Thank you.
I
always speak in Arabic, although Mr. Adnan made me afraid of the disasters that are waiting for Russia in the future. I think these are illusions or not true fears. I think, or disasters, I think Russia did not say, and no official, no Russian official said that the Arab Spring is a conspiracy, a Western conspiracy or regional conspiracy at all. And if you had read what I wrote in many of my articles, I wrote something quite different of what you said, but some people think that way in all over the world about these developments. As for Syria, it is clear, as I said, and it is said by the analysts, the Russian analysts and politicians, that our objective is national reconciliation and to solve this Syria, this crisis by the Syrians without foreign intervention. And then we think such an intervention is there. There is a direct intervention by some countries, networks, and powers. That's why the reconciliation and the national dialogue might be as a method or an approach, but if we look into Geneva 1 and we find that there is a very clear decision in Geneva 1, it is about the transitional authority with all its responsibilities and mandates, and Russia had signed this decision, like approved it. That's why Geneva 2 is built, in fact, on Geneva 1. And that's why we see that stopping violence of, on both sides, Russia thinks that violence is perpetrated by two sides, and the responsibility of this violence and resolving to violence is made by both parties of the conflict. And if there are two parties, not more than two parties in the conflict. On the other hand, Russia wants Syria to stay a unified country, and there is a real threat that the summarization of the conflict of Syria or this crisis, there's a power that wants to tear apart Syria, and Russia is against such a scenario. The only scenario for us is an agreement between the conflicting powers, and we take into consideration that the regime is still enjoys support by a given proportion of the population. The Syrian society is divided sectarially and politically, and also divided over other lines. That's why in this divided society, as we see, there is no way for any other solution but the reconciliation. We know many examples when the international community could solve the crises of civil wars and bloodshed that were even larger than what took place in Syria. Take example Cambodia. We know many positive examples of reconciliation. Yemen at the present time, and thanks to the Gulf Initiative. So why not have such a formula or such approach for a solution in Syria? We are against the logic of toppling down the regimes on the hands of foreign countries. This is one of the lessons that we learned on the past experience lately. Finally, and only to answer your question, I would want to say that the Russian people, who had made a lot of sacrifices to support and help the transitional movements in the Arab world, including for the helping the Palestinians and all the peoples of the region. And I'm surprised that my colleague, academic, has forgotten this fact and says that Russia gives nothing to the region. Thank you, Dr. Thank you for this answer. And now let me speak Arabic also, as everybody is speaking Arabic. My question is to Dr. Adnan. Don't you think that this is what Russia has, and was not give everything it could to Arabs. It supported Saddam Hussein, it supported Egypt, supported the Christian cause, but within the limits that it can do so, the diplomatic support to Iraq and political support to Iraq. But at a certain stage, when things began to go into the military intervention, Russia could not change its position at such a way that to make a military countervention against the United States for the regime of Iraq. Don't you think that it has did what it could, Russia? And the second part of the question, do you see that these changes or transformations, any possible changes in the Russian position in Syria or the region, do you think this strategy will continue the way it is now in Russian? I think that the Arab countries must not forget the support it gets from Russia or USA or other countries. For a long time, they depended, as was said by my colleague, Russia for some time did support some of the liberation movements and some of the communist parties in the Arab countries, which were banned in most of the Arab countries. Hold the microphone, please. But the Arab Spring was a strategic change and an opportunity for many research centers in the Arab world and for the Arab nation to rethink the roles played whether by Russia, which we consider as the closest to the region, geographically speaking. But we know that, and we don't want to going to the past history, we know the Russian history, even before the Cold War, it's all the history and the conflict in this region. But maybe the last straw was the its position regarding Syria. In fact, أنا لم أستخدم أسلوب العلمي بل حاولت أن I tried to find some justifications for Russia's role and its active role. Since the arrival of Putin, Russia has tried to have an independent role of the West. But we don't see that on the ground. Maybe its potential and capabilities are not possible. Even the American military, the Russian military base in Tartus does not have Russia cannot use the forces in that base in a way that would be dangerous for the American forces in the region. Even the military base that is being thought of now in Egypt, from a popular point of view, not academic one, thinking that Russia might have a positive and active role in helping the Arab world. This is the hope of all Arabs in democracy and liberty and economically and economic help. We know the economic aid has dangerous consequences for the Arabs. Maybe there will be a success next month in Geneva and the bloodshed will stop, but I think if we make organize a poll in most of the Arab countries, we find that if the popularity of the Americans is less than 20%, we'll find that it's even less than that for Russia, despite the many reservations that Arab peoples have about America. But also, and now we open the way for questions and of the audience. If they want to comment or speak, ask Dr. Zakaria. In the name of God, the most merciful, the most compassionate, thank you, Dr. Adnan, for this presentation. In fact, I have some fast points that I want to elaborate. First of all, when you speak of the Soviet Union, how it supported all Arab liberation movements, although that it planted the communist thinking which we are suffering now, because those who are governing Egypt now are communists. Blawi, Salem, they are all the people who rule Egypt now are all communists. They are there to fight Islam. And, in fact, Russia has become from an enemy of USA to the ball boy of the tennis game of USA. So what Egypt is doing and against the coup is an American game to cover the fact that USA is the patron of this coup. That's why it put Russia in this position. Russia wants to build a military base in Egypt, I would say that Russia has lost nothing. We've seen nothing in Egypt of Russia except the dancers who come there. As for the railway that will be built there, it will kill the canal, Suez Canal. I stop out there to let the others speak, and I say to Russia, if you want to come to Egypt, you should come as a Russia and not as a shade of USA or shadow.
For your discussions, two quick questions, Professor Vitali. One is, in your discussion of Russia's relations with the region, you didn't have a chance to really talk about Palestine, which is an indication of how much is going on in the region. Could you tell us what your understanding is of how Russia feels about the quartet and how what role it's played in that and what it feels about the future of that process? And on Syria, one brief question. If the deal in Geneva is essentially an alliance between parts of the regime and the opposition against the jihadists, with the condition that Assad goes, which seems to be a condition, is that something Russia could support, do you think?
Thank you. Dr. Vitali?
Oh. Arabic or English, man?
Libraya.
Arabic. I want to react. Very shortly to what my friend Dr. Adnan said about the fact that Russia was supporting only communist factions within them. It's not true. For instance, Libya emerged as an independent state due to the position of Russia in the 20s. Do you know this well? If you are a historian. And I can, I don't have time, but I can name to you so a lot of other examples how Russia was working. On the contrary, if we take the documents revealed from the Soviet archives, Russia was very active to prevent some Arab communist parties from undertaking adventures in trying to seize power in certain regions. It was more pragmatic than anywhere else, but Russia was the first, or the Soviet Union, was the first state that established a relationship with the Saudi Arabia, and the first one that recognized the kingdom, so before all other states. You know this also very well, and was very sympathetic towards this. So, but we don't, let's not go to history. By the way, about the present so-called base in Tartu, there is no base. There's about 50 personnel for cleaning up vessels, and it's not essentially important from the any military strategic point of view. With it or without it, we don't have bases with the exception of the post-Soviet space. We have a base in Armenia, we have a base in Tajikistan, and nowhere else. And we closed our bases in Kamran, in Vietnam, and in Cuba. It's over. We had two big bases. They were closed. Russia has no ambitions to be anywhere, to have military presence anywhere, especially in the Arab world. We have nothing against the American military presence in the Gulf, if it's done on the request of the local states that want American protection for its security. And we are very pleased with the cooperation with the United States and here on many issues, including the weapons of mass destruction, and including our role in the quartet in trying to provide soil for the solution of the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. Coming back to Syria, I can tell you that we also have a lot of skepticism about the forthcoming conference, but we have hopes that it will be held. It's a beginning of the process, in my view, only the beginning of the process. Whatever happens there can happen. And it's a very long process. If you look at Dayton, for instance, there was the conflicting sides. Everything was prepared, but they were sitting together in one room for three, closed in one room for 3 weeks before reaching an agreement. I don't think that it will be easy to reach an agreement, but the fact that the conflicting sides negotiate is much better than killing each other. And we don't forget that in accordance with, as I can repeat that there are more than 30,000 foreign jihadists in Syria, and we cannot ignore this fact. And I don't think that their goals, if we are asking each other about the goals and objectives, that their goals and objectives are democracy in Syria or building a democratic state for all communities in this country, where we have Christians, Alawites, Druze, Circassians, and we care about these minorities very much, because we have our, you know, brothers in the Orthodox religion in Syria. We remember that in Iraq, for instance, of 1,400,000 Christians, only a little bit more than 3,000 Christians are left due to the attitudes on the part of radical groups against them. Let's, to be fair, let's don't forget that about half of a million people have been killed during 10 years, last 10 years in Iraq as well, and nobody could provide security and safety of these people. So it's not black and white. I am against black and white picture. I agree that there can be different views. I agree that we can suffer some, you know, defeats from the point of view of our popularity. But we, in general, the main view of Russians is that this stance is ethically, you know,
right.
And we have justifications for that. And we'll see what will come out of that.
Thank you.
I think I forgot to mention that, yes, I think you're right about so many things about supporting some countries. And I forget to mention that Russia is the main supporter of chemical weapons to Syria. And it's supporting now.
No, it was European states. You know this very well. Russia has never used chemical weapons, never supported anyone. The first use of chemical weapons in the region was done by Britain in 1917, not by Russia.
I think you're right. And they got some part of it even from Americans, going around, getting some fertilizers and using it for chemical purposes. But this is a huge example that Russia is supporting, and it is witnessed by millions of people.
What millions? Where did you find
the chemical weapons?
Coming from Russia to Syria, chemical weapons?
What is stockpile coming to Syria? It just came from nowhere. It was not originated from Russia. Russia has no part of it.
I can tell you that it's coming from Jordan. Why not?
No, you
are telling me that it's from Russia. Why? Why not from Jordan, or why not from Nepal?
I can give you one simple question. Answer that the Americans, when they're talking about the Russian about reaching a deal about the chemical weapons, they knew that how much the size of 1,000 metric And they got all of the numbers
1,
and the size.
1,000 tons.
Yes, 1,000 tons. Exactly. Okay. So is that a good...
Produced in Syria with the help of European companies.
European, American companies, and Buckmeal is coming from
Germany, a lot of other states. Not directly, but indirectly.
No, that's not made even. I don't want to get in a pink hand.
Okay.
Let's be fair, my friend.
I'm trying to be fair.
And precise. We're academics.
Precise. Okay, I'm an academician, and if you say that the chemical weapons in Syria are not originated from Russia, I would have to believe you because I do not have the citation and the source
right now with me.
And if anybody can help us from the audience and say where it's coming from. So it is not the fault of the Russian, and if it is not the fault of the Russian, would excuse us about...
Then forget about that if you don't know.
Okay, we forget about it. So it is the Americans to bash and blame.
Okay, let's take other questions. Yes, sir.
Good.
I would like to ask you, Professor Namkin, about...
أوجه سؤالي حول العلاقات الإسرائيلية الروسية. هل بإمكانك أن تعلق على ذلك في السنوات القليلة الماضية؟ هناك زيادة وتعزيز العلاقات في مجال الطاقة والتجارة. هل يمكن أن تبين لنا كيف تتعامل...
A discussion in the region about the potential role of Russia as a protector, let's say, of the Christian minority. So if you can elaborate, please, on this.
All right. Other questions? Okay. Professor Vitali.
As you know, Russia is a strong supporter of the peace process as the only way to come out of this protracted crisis. And we are a member of the Quartet. Though I can acknowledge that probably the United States is more active in playing a role, but also the United States is considered as a bias because Israel is regarded as a strategic partner of the United States in the region. And as our American partners usually say, Israel and the conflict is not a part of our foreign policy, it's a part of our internal policy. So,
it's for the Americans.
So, I say that our relationship with Israel now, which is developing, and we have in general good relationship. This gives us some leverage to play a more active role, a proactive role in the peace process. Though I'm very skeptical about the perspective of peace process, given the character of the present government in Israel, I'm very critical towards what it's doing. And Russia in general is critical, but still we have relations. We are frank in our discussions with the Israelis. And Russia expressed its view against the construction of new settlements and was in favor of freezing all construction, you know, before negotiations. It didn't work. And so as far as the Christian minorities are considered, we're very much, we care about the Christian life in Israel. We have a big supporters of Christian life. We are investing a lot of money in reconstructing and supporting monasteries, Christian monasteries, and Christian communities there. We have several organizations, one of those headed by Mr. Yakunin, who is chairman of the Russian Railway Roads, who is providing significant help to the Orthodox community, Arab, of course, community in Israel.
Thank you very much. I have a question, actually, Professor Vitali, which is a long time ago, I've always been familiar with the protests happening in the region, and I'm used to this image of people in the streets in the region, in the Middle East region,
yes.
Of people burning American flags. in the region. This is like the scene or the image that I grew up with, you know, looking at the region and protest, and so became the tradition over the past decades of people in the streets and, you know, burning American flags and all that. Recently, I mean, with the beginning of the Arab Spring, we started to see some new things where actually the Russian flag also has joined and people burning the Russian flag. My question is Russia concerned about the future relationship with this region? Or why, you know, because this is, I mean, as you know, with all the polls that overwhelmingly supporting the Syrian revolution, among the Arab street, and with Russia being viewed as the country that's blocking a resolution in the Security Council or something, blocking a resolution. Does this concern Russia on the long term and its future relationship with the region? And one major mistake that I understand that the U.S. foreign policy did over the past half century in this region, that it always allied with the regimes, over the alliance or the support or understanding the needs of the people. And many American politicians admitted to this, including Condoleezza Rice, of course, you know, with this struggle over stability and security and interest and values, and we didn't achieve stability or democracy, as she said. So there is this concern of a mistake that U.S. foreign policy did over the past half century in the region. Is Russia concerned that it's doing the same mistake of allying with, I mean, who allies with the Assad regime now? The Assad regime is in the weakest position, I mean, since, you know, the 70s or the 60s. Since they came to power, and now it's the weakest position, and now, I mean, with Russia allying or supporting the way at least by the perceived by the people, does that concern Russia over the future? Thank you.
First of all, we don't consider ourselves allied with Assad. We are allied with the reconciliation paradigm, not with Assad, especially Assad personal. But let's take into account that practically Assad is a partner of the international community now in two things. In the preparation for Geneva II, because whoever comes to Geneva, he'll be representing the existing regime. And second, the elimination of chemical weapons. You need this partner at least for the next 6 months.
Yeah.
We are not working for the sake of the of Assad remaining at power. Not at all. By the way, the Americans don't care about their flags. Why should we care?
They got used.
Whoever is burning.
They got used that.
we were the same question. We were discussing the same question with, by the way, with Condoleezza Rice, yeah, when I participated in the last Sir Banias Forum in Abu Dhabi, where we were sitting at the panel with General Salim Idris,
yes,
of the Free Syrian Army, and Sheikh Ahmed Jarba. And it was hot dialogue, but a bit more academic than our dialogue with my friend Dr. Adnan. I would say
why are you saying that?
But by the way, you know, about
the regime. I think you took some of the information as at the personal level. And when I talked with Ibrahim, and I think I said, well, this is academic freedom and you can say whatever you want
to
say.
Yes, of course you are free. I'm in
but
favor of freedom.
I let it go once and twice and three times. I tried to ignore it and I'll ignore it again.
Oh, please. Okay. Sure. It's done. The last Manama dialogue where I came from yesterday, you know. So the main concern of the states of this region, of the Gulf, was that, oh my God, it will be a disaster if Americans leave this region. So probably the popularity of Americans is low, but the country, the regimes, they want Americans to protect them. And I understand this very well. They are playing a certain role. So the popularity is not a measure of success of this or that country or it's very difficult to interpret its policy in the terms of reliance either on regimes or on peoples or public. So the same about Russia. I agree that, of course, Syria is a weak regime, but we're working not for Assad, not advocating Assad, not supporting him, but advocating non-interference. And by the way, at Manama, the Manama dialogue, there was one of the participants was Senator Kale, head of the subcommittee for the Committee of Foreign Relations at the Senate. He said the toppling Assad is not our goal in Syria. We have other objectives. It's the same about Russia. We understand that it's not our goal. We have other goals, along with our Western partners. And let the Syrians themselves decide who is going to rule Syria.
Thank you, Dr. Adnan.
I have to say one thing. Nobody can say anything about without looking to the role of the United States. But when you talk about popularity of Russia among the Arab public, if you ask the Arab youth who is going to study in Russia right now in comparison to the United States, people will choose the United States. Does Russia represent a model of democracy? And if you look at the Freedom House, you will see it is non-democracy. It's nobody wants to be like Russia. Russia is not a role model for the Arabs. The expectation of Russia is it's an illusion by the Arab public that they may stop the influence of the United States. And we are wrong at that too. Thank you.
Thank you. Any final questions? Okay, well, with that, I would like to thank you both for this discussion.